By 1985, I had added drug addiction to my alcohol problem, yet I continued to function, as a good many substance abusers do, on a marginally competent level. I was terrified not to. By then, I had no idea of how to live any other life. I hid the drugs I was taking as well as I could, both out of terror. What would happen to me without dope? I had forgotten the trick of being straight. And out of shame. I was wiping my ass with poison ivy again, this time on a daily basis, but I couldn't ask for help. That's not the way you did things in my family. In my family, what you did was smoke your cigarettes and dance in the jello and keep yourself to yourself. Yet the part of me that writes the stories, the deep part that knew I was an alcoholic as early as 1975 when I wrote The Shining, wouldn't accept that. Silence isn't what that part is about. It began to scream for help in the only way it knew how, through my fiction and through my monsters. In late 1985 and early 1986, I wrote Misery, the title quite aptly described my state of mind, in which a writer is held prisoner and tortured by a psychotic nurse. In the spring and summer of 1986, I wrote The Tommyknockers, often working until midnight, with my heart running at 130 beats a minute, and cotton swabs stuck up my nose to stem the coke-induced bleeding. Tommyknockers is a 40s-style science fiction tale in which the writer heroine discovers an alien spacecraft buried in the ground. The crew is still on board, not dead, but only hibernating. These alien creatures got into your head and just started, well, Tommyknocking around in there. What you got was energy and a kind of superficial intelligence. The writer, Bobby Anderson, creates a telepathic typewriter and an atomic hot water heater, among other things. What you gave up in exchange was your soul. It was the best metaphor for drugs and alcohol my tired, overstressed mind could come up with. Not long after that, my wife, finally convinced that I wasn't going to pull out of this ugly downward spiral on my own, stepped in. It couldn't have been easy. By then I was no longer within shouting distance of my right mind, but she did it. She organized an intervention group formed of family and friends, and I was treated to a kind of this is your life in hell. Tabby began by dumping a trash bag full of stuff from my office out on the rug. Beer cans, cigarette butts, cocaine in gram bottles and cocaine in plastic baggies, coke spoons caked with snot and blood, Valium, Xanax, bottles of Robitussin cough syrup and NyQuil cold medicine, even bottles of mouthwash. A year or so before, observing the rapidity with which huge bottles of Listerine were disappearing from the bathroom, Tabby asked me if I drank the stuff. I responded with self-righteous hauteur that I most certainly did not. Nor did I. I drank the scope instead. It was tastier, had that hint of mint. The point of this intervention, which was certainly as unpleasant for my wife and kids and friends as it was for me, was that I was dying in front of them. Tabby said I had my choice. I could get help at a rehab, or I could get the hell out of the house. She said that she and the kids loved me, and for that very reason none of them wanted to witness my suicide. I bargained because that's what addicts do. I was charming because that's what addicts are. In the end, I got 2 weeks to think about it. In retrospect, this seems to summarize all the insanity of that time. Guy is standing on top of a burning building. Helicopter arrives, hovers, drops a rope ladder. Climb up, the man leaning out of the helicopter door shouts. Guy on top of the burning building responds, give me 2 weeks to think about it. I did think, though, as well as I could in my addled state, and what finally decided me was Annie Wilkes, the psycho nurse in Misery. Annie was coke. Annie was booze, and I decided I was tired of being Annie's pet writer. I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to work anymore if I quit drinking and drugging, but I decided, again, so far as I was able to decide anything in my distraught and depressed state of mind, that I would trade writing for staying married and watching the kids grow up, if it came to that. It didn't, of course. The idea that creative endeavor and mind-altering substances are entwined is one of the great pop intellectual myths of our time. The four 20th century writers whose work is most responsible for it are probably Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Sherwood Anderson, and the poet Dylan Thomas. They are the writers who largely formed our vision of an existential English-speaking wasteland where people have been cut off from one another and live in an atmosphere of emotional strangulation and despair. These concepts are very familiar to most alcoholics. The common reaction to them is amusement. Substance-abusing writers are just substance abusers, common garden-variety drunks and druggies, in other words. Any claims that drugs and alcohol are necessary to dull a finer sensibility are just the usual self-serving bullshit. I've heard alcoholic snowplow drivers make the same claim, that they drink to still the demons. It doesn't matter if you're James Jones, John Cheever, or a stew bum snoozing in Penn Station. For an addict, the right to the drink or drug of choice must be preserved at all costs. Hemingway and Fitzgerald didn't drink because they were creative, alienated, or morally weak. They drank because it's what alkies are wired up to do. Creative people probably do run a greater risk of alcoholism and addiction than those in some other jobs, but so what? We all look pretty much the same when we're puking in the gutter. At the end of my adventures, I was drinking a case of 16-ounce tall boys a night, and there's one novel, Cujo, that I barely remember writing at all. I don't say that with pride or shame, only with a vague sense of sorrow and loss. I like that book. I wish I could remember enjoying the good parts as I put them down on the page. At the worst of it, I no longer wanted to drink and no longer wanted to be sober either. I felt evicted from life. At the start of the road back, I just tried to believe the people who said that things would get better if I gave them time to do so. And I never stopped writing. Some of the stuff that came out was tentative and flat, but at least it was there. I buried those unhappy, lackluster pages in the bottom drawer of my desk and got on to the next project. Little by little, I found the beat again, and after that, I found the joy again. I came back to my family with gratitude and back to my work with relief. I came back to it the way folks come back to a summer cottage after a long winter, checking first to make sure nothing has been stolen or broken during the cold season. Nothing had been. It was still all there, still all whole. Once the pipes were thawed out and the electricity was turned back on, everything worked fine. The last thing I want to tell you in this part is about my desk. For years, I dreamed of having the sort of massive oak slab that would dominate a room. No more child's desk in a trailer laundry closet. No more cramped knee hole in a rented house. In 1981, I got the one I wanted and placed it in the middle of a spacious skylighted study. It's a converted stable loft at the rear of the house. For 6 years, I sat behind that desk either drunk or wrecked out of my mind, like a ship's captain in charge of a voyage to nowhere. A year or so after I sobered up, I got rid of that monstrosity and put in a living room suite where it had been, picking out the pieces and a nice Turkish rug with my wife's help. In the early 90s, before they moved on to their own lives, my kids sometimes came up in the evening to watch a basketball game or a movie and eat pizza. They usually left a box full of crusts behind when they moved on, but I didn't care. They came, they seemed to enjoy being with me, and I know I enjoyed being with them. I got another desk. It's handmade, beautiful, and half the size of the T-Rex desk. I put it at the far west end of the office, in a corner, under the eave. That eave is very like the one I slept under in Durham, but there are no rats in the walls and no senile grandmother downstairs yelling for someone to feed Dick, the horse. I'm sitting under it now, a 53-year-old man with bad eyes, a gimp leg, and no hangover. I'm doing what I know how to do, and as well as I know how to do it. I came through all the stuff I told you about, and plenty more I didn't, and now I'm going to tell you as much as I can about the job. As promised, it won't take long. It starts with this. Put your desk in the corner, and every time you sit down there to write, remind yourself why it isn't in the middle of the room. Life isn't a support system for art. It's the other way around. What writing is? Telepathy, of course. It's amusing when you stop to think about it. For years, people have argued about whether or not such a thing exists. Folks like J.B. Rhine have busted their brains trying to create a valid testing process to isolate it. And all the time, it's been right there, lying out in the open like Mr. Poe's purloined letter. All the arts depend upon telepathy to some degree, but I believe that writing offers the purest distillation. Perhaps I'm prejudiced, but even if I am, we may as well stick with writing since it's what we came here to think and talk about. My name is Stephen King. I'm writing the first draft of this part at my desk, the one under the eave, on a snowy morning in December of 1997. There are things on my mind, summer worries, bad eyes, Christmas shopping not even started, wife under the weather with a virus. Some are good things. Our younger son made a surprise visit home from college. I got to play The Clash's brand new Cadillac with the Wallflowers at a concert. But right now, all that stuff is up top. I'm in another place, a basement place where there are lots of bright lights and clear images. This is a place I've built for myself over the years. It's a far-seeing place. I know it's a little strange, a little bit of a contradiction, that a far-seeing place should also be a basement place, but that's how it is with me. If you construct your own far-seeing place, you might put it in a treetop, or on the roof of the World Trade Center, or on the edge of the Grand Canyon. That's your little red wagon, as Robert McCammon says in one of his novels. This book is scheduled to be published in the late summer or early fall of 2000. If that's how things work out, then you are somewhere downstream on the timeline from me. But you're quite likely in your own far-seeing place, the one where you go to receive telepathic messages. Not that you have to be there. Books are a uniquely portable magic. I usually listen to one in the car, always unabridged. I think abridged audiobooks are the pits, and carry another wherever I go. You'll just never know when you'll want an escape hatch. Mile-long lines at toll booth plazas, the 15 minutes you have to spend in the hall of some boring college building waiting for your advisor who's got some yank-off in there threatening to commit suicide because he, she is flunking custom kerm-furling 101 to come out so you can get his signature on a drop card, airport boarding lounges, laundromats on rainy afternoons, and the absolute worst, which is the doctor's office when the guy is running late and you have to wait half an hour in order to have something sensitive mauled. At such times, I find a book vital. If I have to spend time in purgatory before going to one place or the other, I guess I'll be all right as long as there's a lending library. And if there is, it's probably stocked with nothing but novels by Danielle Steele and chicken soup books. Ha ha, joke's on you, Steve. So, I read where I can, but I have a favorite place, and probably you do too. A place where the light is good and the vibe is usually strong. For me, it's the blue chair in my study. For you, it might be the couch on the sun porch, the rocker in the kitchen, or maybe it's propped up in your bed. Reading in bed can be heaven, assuming you can get just the right amount of light on the page and aren't prone to spilling your coffee or cognac on the sheets. So let's assume that you're in your favorite receiving place, just as I am in the place where I do my best transmitting. We'll have to perform our mentalist routine not just over distance, but over time as well. Yet that presents no real problem. If we can still read Dickens, Shakespeare, and, with the help of a footnote or two, Herodotus, I think we can manage the gap between 1997 and 2000. And here we go, actual telepathy in action. You'll notice that I have nothing up my sleeves, and that except for the audio version, my lips never move. Neither, most likely, do yours. Look. Here's a table covered with a red cloth. On it is a cage the size of a small fish aquarium. In the cage is a white rabbit with a pink nose and pink-rimmed eyes. In its front paws is a carrot stub upon which it is contentedly munching. On its back, clearly marked in blue ink, is the numeral 8. Do we see the same thing? We'd have to get together and compare notes to make absolutely sure, but I think we do. There will be necessary variations, of course. Some receivers will see a cloth which is turkey red, some will see one that's scarlet, while others may see still other shades. To colorblind receivers, the red tablecloth is the dark gray of cigar ashes. Some may see scalloped edges, some may see straight ones. Decorative souls may add a little lace and welcome. My tablecloth is your tablecloth. Knock yourself out. Likewise, the matter of the cage leaves quite a lot of room for individual interpretation. For one thing, it is described in terms of rough comparison, which is useful only if you and I see the world and measure the things in it with similar eyes. It's easy to become careless when making rough comparisons, but the alternative is a prissy attention to detail that takes all the fun out of writing. What am I going to say? On the table is a cage 3 feet 6 inches in length, 2 feet in width, and 14 inches high? That's not prose. That's an instruction manual. The paragraph also doesn't tell us what sort of material the cage is made of. Wire mesh? Steel rods? Glass? But does it really matter? We all understand the cage is a see-through medium. Beyond that, we don't care. The most interesting thing here isn't even the carrot-munching rabbit in the cage, but the number on its back. Not a 6, not a 4, not 19.5, it's an 8. This is what we're looking at, and we all see it. I didn't tell you. You didn't ask me. I never opened my mouth, except in that audio version, and you never opened yours. We're not even in the same year together, let alone the same room, except we are together. We're close. We're having a meeting of the minds. I sent you a table with a red cloth on it, a cage, a rabbit, and the number 8 in blue ink. You got them all, especially that blue 8. We've engaged in an act of telepathy. No mythy mountain shit, real telepathy. I'm not going to belabor the point, but before we go any further, you have to understand that I'm not trying to be cute. There is a point to be made. You can approach the act of writing with nervousness, excitement, hopefulness, or even despair, the sense that you can never completely put on the page what's in your mind and heart. You can come to the act with your fists clenched and your eyes narrowed, ready to kick ass and take down names. You can come to it because you want a girl to marry you or because you want to change the world. Come to it anyway, but lightly. Let me say that again. You must not come lightly to the blank page. I'm not asking you to come reverently or unquestioningly. I'm not asking you to be politically correct or cast aside your sense of humor. Please, God, you have one. This isn't a popularity contest. It's not the Moral Olympics, and it's not church. But it's writing, damn it, not washing the car or putting on eyeliner. If you can take it seriously, we can do business. If you can't or won't, it's time for you to close the book or eject the tape and do something else. Wash the car, maybe. Toolbox. Grandpa was a carpenter. He built houses, stores, and banks. He chain-smoked Camel cigarettes and hammered nails in planks. He was level on the level, shaved even every door, and voted for Eisenhower, 'cause Lincoln won the war. John Prine. That's one of my favorite John Prine lyrics, probably because my grandpa was also a carpenter. I don't know about stores and banks, but Guy Pillsbury built his share of houses and spent a good many years making sure the Atlantic Ocean and the harsh seacoast winters didn't wash away the Winslow Homer estate in Prout's Neck. Faza smoked cigars, though, not Camels. It was my Uncle Orrin, also a carpenter, who smoked the Camels. And when Faza retired, it was Uncle Orrin who inherited the old fellow's toolbox. I don't remember its being there in the garage on the day I dropped the cinder block on my foot, but it probably was sitting in its accustomed place, just outside the nook where my cousin Donald kept his hockey sticks, ice skates, and baseball glove. The toolbox was what we called a big'un. It had 3 levels, the top 2 removable, all 3 containing little drawers as cunning as Chinese boxes. It was handmade, of course. Dark wooden slats were bound together by tiny nails and strips of brass. The lid was held down by big latches. To my child's eye, they looked like the latches on a giant's lunchbox. Inside the top was a silk lining, rather odd in such a context and made more striking still by the pattern, which was pinkish-red cabbage roses fading into a smog of grease and dirt. On the sides were great big grab handles. You never saw a toolbox like this one for sale at Walmart or Western Auto, believe me. When my uncle first got it, he found a brass etching of a famous Homer painting, I believe it was the Undertow, lying in the bottom. Some years later, Uncle Orrin had it authenticated by a Homer expert in New York, and a few years after that, I believe he sold it for a good piece of money. Exactly how or why Faza came by the engraving in the first place is a mystery, but there was no mystery about the origins of the toolbox. He made it himself. One summer day, I helped Uncle Orrin replace a broken screen on the far side of the house. I might have been 8 or 9 at the time. I remember following him with the replacement screen balanced on my head, like a native bearer in a Tarzan movie. He had the toolbox by the grab handles, horsing it along at thigh level. As always, Uncle Orrin was wearing khaki pants and a clean white T-shirt. Sweat gleamed in his graying army crew cut. A camel hung from his lower lip. When I came in years later with a pack of Chesterfields in my breast pocket, Uncle Orrin sneered at them and called them stockade cigarettes. We finally reached the window with the broken screen, and he set the toolbox down with an audible sigh of relief. When Dave and I tried to lift it from its place on the garage floor, each of us holding one of the handles, we could barely budge it. Of course, we were just little kids back then, but even so, I'd guess that Faza's fully loaded toolbox weighed between 80 and 120 pounds. Uncle Orrin let me undo the big latches. The common tools were all on the top layer of the box. There was a hammer, a saw, the pliers, a couple of sized wrenches, and an adjustable. There was a level with that mystic yellow window in the middle, a drill, the various bits were neatly drawered farther down in the depths, and 2 screwdrivers. Uncle Orrin asked me for a screwdriver. "Which one?" I asked. "Either or," he replied. The broken screen was held on by loop head screws, and it really didn't matter whether he used a regular screwdriver or the Phillips on them. With loop heads, you just stuck the screwdriver's barrel through the hole at the top of the screw and then spun it the way you'd spin a tire iron once you've got the lug nuts loose. Uncle Orrin took the screws out. There were 8, which he handed to me for safekeeping, and then removed the old screen. He set it against the house and held up the new one. The holes in the screen's frame made it up neatly with the holes in the window frame. Uncle Orrin grunted with approval when he saw this. He took the loop head screws back from me, one after the other, got them started with his fingers, then tightened them down just as he'd loosened them by inserting the screwdriver's barrel through the loops and turning them. When the screen was secure, Uncle Orrin gave me the screwdriver and told me to put it back in the toolbox and latch her up. I did, but I was puzzled. I asked him why he'd lugged Faza's toolbox all the way around the house if all he'd needed was that one screwdriver. He could have carried a screwdriver in the back pocket of his khakis. "Yeah, but Stevie," he said, bending to grasp the handles, "I didn't know what else I might find to do once I got out here, did I? It's best to have your tools with you. If you don't, you're apt to find something you didn't expect and get discouraged." I want to suggest that to write to your best abilities, it behooves you to construct your own toolbox and then build up enough muscle so you can carry it with you. Then, instead of looking at a hard job and getting discouraged, you will perhaps seize the correct tool and get immediately to work. Faza's toolbox had 3 levels. I think that yours should have at least 4. You could have 5 or 6, I suppose, but there comes a point where a toolbox becomes too large to be portable and thus loses its chief virtue. You'll also want all those little drawers for your screws and nuts and bolts, but where you put those drawers and what you put in them, well, that's your little red wagon, isn't it? You'll find you have most of the tools you need already, but I advise you to look at each again as you load it into your box. Try to see each one new. Remind yourself of its function, and if some are rusty, as they may be if you haven't done this seriously in a while, clean them off. Common tools go on top. The commonest of all, the bread of writing, is vocabulary. In this case, you can happily pack what you have without the slightest bit of guilt and inferiority. As the whore said to the bashful sailor, "It ain't how much you've got, honey, it's how you use it." Some writers have enormous vocabularies. These are folks who'd know if there really is such a thing as an insalubrious dithyram or a cozening raconteur. People who haven't missed a multiple-choice answer in Wilford Funk's "It Pays to Increase Your Word Power" in, 30 years or so. For example, the leathery, undeteriorative, and almost indestructible quality was an inherent attribute of the thing's form of organization and pertained to some Paleogean cycle of invertebrate evolution utterly beyond our powers of speculation. H.P. Lovecraft, At the Mountains of Madness. Like it? Here's another. In some of the cups, there was no evidence whatever that anything had been planted. In others, wilted brown stalks gave testimony to some inscrutable depredation. T. Corasson Boyle, Budding Prospects. And yet a third. This is a good one. You'll like it. Someone snatched the old woman's blindfold from her, and she and the juggler were clouted away. And when the company turned into sleep and the low fire was roaring in the blast like a thing alive, these four yet crouched at the edge of the firelight among their strange chattels and watched how the ragged flames fled down the wind as if sucked by some maelstrom out there in the void, some vortex in that waste apposite to which man's transit and his reckonings alike lay abrogate. Cormac McCarthy, Blood Meridian. Other writers use smaller, simpler vocabularies. Examples of this hardly seem necessary, but I'll offer a couple of my favorites just the same. He came to the river. The river was there. Ernest Hemingway, Big Two-Hearted River. They caught the kid doing something nasty under the bleachers. Theodore Sturgeon, Some of Your Blood. This is what happened. Douglas Fairbairn, Shoot. Some of the owner men were kind because they hated what they had to do, and some of them were angry because they hated to be cruel, and some of them were cold because they had long ago found that one could not be an owner unless one were cold. John Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath. The Steinbeck sentence is especially interesting. It's 50 words long. Of those 50 words, 39 have but one syllable. That leaves 11, but even that number is deceptive. Steinbeck uses because 3 times, owner twice, and hated twice. There is no word longer than 2 syllables in the entire sentence. The structure is complex. The vocabulary is not far removed from the old Dick and Jane primers. The Grapes of Wrath is, of course, a fine novel. I believe that Blood Meridian is another, although there are great whacks of it that I don't fully understand. What of that? I can't decipher the words to many of the popular songs I love either. There's also stuff you'll never find in the dictionary, but it's still vocabulary. Check out the following.
Hey, what do you? What do you want from me?
Here come Jaime.
Chew my willy, yawna.
Yeah, fuck you too, man.
Tom Wolfe, Bonfire of the Vanities. The last is phonetically rendered street vocabulary. Few writers have Wolfe's ability to translate such stuff to the page. Elmore Leonard is another writer who can do it. Some street rap gets into the dictionary eventually, but not until it's safely dead, and I don't think you'll ever find "yuck" in Webster's Unabridged. Put your vocabulary on the top shelf of your toolbox and don't make any conscious effort to improve it. You'll be doing that as you read, of course, but that comes later. One of the really bad things you can do to your writing is to dress up the vocabulary looking for long words because you're maybe a little bit ashamed of your short ones. This is like dressing up a household pet in evening clothes. The pet is embarrassed, and the person who committed this act of premeditated cuteness should be even more embarrassed. Make yourself a solemn promise right now that you'll never use emolument when you mean tip, and you'll never say John stopped long enough to perform an act of excretion when you mean John stopped long enough to take a shit. If you believe take a shit would be considered offensive or inappropriate by your audience, feel free to say that John stopped long enough to move his bowels, or perhaps John stopped long enough to push. I'm not trying to get you to talk dirty, only plain and direct. Remember that the basic rule of vocabulary is use the first word that comes to your mind, if it's appropriate and colorful. If you hesitate and cogitate, you will come up with another word. Of course you will. There's always another word. But it probably won't be as good as your first one, or as close to what you really mean. This business of meaning is a very big deal. If you doubt it, think of all the times you've heard someone say, "I just can't describe it." Or, "That isn't what I mean." Think of all the times you've said those things yourself, usually in a tone of mild or serious frustration. The word is only a representation of the meaning. Even at its best, writing almost always falls short of full meaning. Given that, why in God's name would you want to make things worse by choosing a word which is only cousin to the one you really wanted to use? And do feel free to take appropriateness into account. As George Carlin once observed, in some company it's perfectly all right to prick your finger, but very bad form to finger your prick. You'll also want grammar on the top shelf of your toolbox, and don't annoy me with your moans of exasperation or your cries that you don't understand grammar. You never did understand grammar. You flunked that whole semester in sophomore English. Writing is fun, but grammar sucks, the big one. Relax. Chill. We won't spend much time here because we don't need to. One either absorbs the grammatical principles of one's native language in conversation and in reading, or one does not. What sophomore English does, or tries to do, is little more than the naming of parts. And this is in high school. Now that you're not worried that A, your skirt is too short or too long and the other kids will laugh at you, B, you're not going to make the varsity swimming team, C, you're still going to be a pimple-studded virgin when you graduate, probably when you die for that matter, D, the physics teacher won't grade the final on a curve, or E, nobody really likes you anyway, and they never did. Now that all that extraneous shit is out of the way, you can study certain academic matters with a degree of concentration you could never manage while attending the local textbook loony bin. And once you start, you'll find you know almost all of the stuff anyway. It is, as I said, mostly a matter of cleaning the rust off the drill bits and sharpening the blade of your saw. Plus, oh, to hell with it. If you can remember all the accessories that go with your best outfit, the contents of your purse, the starting lineup of the New York Yankees or the Houston Oilers, or what label Hang On Sloopy by the McCoys was on, you are capable of remembering the difference between a gerund, verb form used as a noun, and a participle, verb form used as an adjective. I thought long and hard about whether or not to include a detailed section on grammar in this little book. Part of me would actually like to. I taught it successfully at high school, where it hid under the name Business English, and I enjoyed it as a student. American grammar doesn't have the sturdiness of British grammar. A British advertising man with a proper education can make magazine copy for ribbed condoms sound like the Magna Goddamn Carta, but it has its own scruffy charm. In the end, I decided against it, probably for the same reason William Strunk decided not to recap the basics when he wrote the first edition of The Elements of Style. If you don't know, it's too late. And those really incapable of grasping grammar, as I am incapable of playing certain guitar riffs and progressions, will have little or no use for a book like this anyway. In that sense, I am preaching to the converted. Yet, allow me to go on just a little bit further. Will you indulge me? Vocabulary used in speech or writing organizes itself into 7 parts of speech. 8, if you count interjections such as, "Oh," and "Gosh," and
forget about it.
Communication composed of these parts of speech must be organized by rules of grammar upon which we agree. When these rules break down, confusion and misunderstanding result. Bad grammar produces bad sentences. My favorite example from Strunk and White is this one. As a mother of five, with another one on the way, my ironing board is always up. Nouns and verbs are the two indispensable parts of writing. Without one of each, no group of words can be a sentence, since a sentence is, by definition, a group of words containing a subject, noun, and a predicate, verb. Those strings of words begin with a capital letter, end with a period, and combine to make a complete thought which starts in the writer's head and then leaps to the reader's. Must you write complete sentences each time, every time? Perish the thought. If your work consists only of fragments and floating clauses, the grammar police aren't going to come and take you away. Even William Strunk, that Mussolini of rhetoric, recognized the delicious pliability of language. It is an old observation, he writes, that the best writers sometimes disregard the rules of rhetoric. Yet he goes on to add this thought, which I urge you to consider. Unless he is certain of doing well, the writer will probably do best to follow the rules. The telling clause here is, unless he is certain of doing well. If you don't have a rudimentary grasp of how the parts of speech translate into coherent sentences, how can you be certain that you are doing well? How will you know if you are doing ill, for that matter? The answer, of course, is that you can't. You won't. One who does grasp the rudiments of grammar finds a comforting simplicity at its heart, where there need be only nouns, the words that name, and verbs, the words that act. Take any noun, put it with any verb, and you have a sentence. It never fails. Rocks explode. Jane transmits. Mountains float. These are all perfect sentences. Many such thoughts make little rational sense, but even the stranger ones, plums deify, have a kind of poetic weight that's nice. The simplicity of noun-verb construction is useful. At the very least, it can provide a safety net for your writing. Strunk and White caution against too many simple sentences in a row, but simple sentences provide a path you can follow when you fear getting lost in the tangles of rhetoric. All those restrictive and non-restrictive clauses, those modifying phrases, those appositives and compound complex sentences. If you start to freak out at the sight of such unmapped territory, unmapped by you at least, just remind yourself that rocks explode, Jane transmits, mountains float, and plums deify. Grammar is not just a pain in the ass. It's the pole you grab to get your thoughts up on their feet and walking. Besides, all those simple sentences worked for Hemingway, didn't they? Even when he was drunk on his ass, he was a fucking genius. If you want to refurbish your grammar, go to your local used bookstore and find a copy of Warriner's English Grammar and Composition, the same book most of us took home and dutifully covered with brown paper shopping bags when we were sophomores and juniors in high school. You'll be relieved and delighted, I think, to find that almost all you need is summarized on the front and back end papers of the book. Despite the brevity of his style manual, William Strunk found room to discuss his own dislikes in matters of grammar and usage. He hated the phrase student body, for instance, insisting that studentry was both clearer and without the ghoulish connotations he saw in the former term. He thought personalize a pretentious word. Strunk suggests get up a letterhead to replace personalize your stationery. He hated phrases such as the fact that and along these lines. I have my own dislikes. I believe that anyone using the phrase, that's so cool, should have to stand in the corner, and that those using the far more odious phrases, at this point in time and at the end of the day, should be sent to bed without supper or writing paper, for that matter. Two of my other pet peeves have to do with this most basic level of writing, and I want to get them off my chest before we move along. Verbs come in two types, active and passive. With an active verb, the subject of the sentence is doing something. With a passive verb, something is being done to the subject of the sentence. The subject is just letting it happen. You should avoid the passive tense. I'm not the only one who says so. You can find the same advice in The Elements of Style. Messrs. Strunk and White don't speculate as to why so many writers are attracted to passive verbs, but I'm willing to. I think timid writers like them for the same reason timid lovers like passive partners. The passive voice is safe. There is no troublesome action to contend with. The subject just has to close its eyes and think of England, to paraphrase Queen Victoria. I think unsure writers also feel the passive voice somehow lends their work authority, perhaps even a quality of majesty. If you find instruction manuals in Lawyer's Torts majestic, I guess it does. The timid fellow writes, "The meeting will be held at 7 o'clock, because that somehow says to him, put it this way and people will believe you really know. Purge this quizzling thought. Don't be a muggle. Throw back your shoulders, stick out your chin, and put that meeting in charge. Right? The meeting's at 7. There, by God, don't you feel better?" I won't say there's no place for the passive tense. Suppose, for instance, a fellow dies in the kitchen but ends up somewhere else. The body was carried from the kitchen and placed on the parlor sofa is a fair way to put this, although was carried and was placed still irked the shit out of me. I accept them, but I don't embrace them. What I would embrace is, Freddie and Myra carried the body out of the kitchen and laid it on the parlor sofa. Why does the body have to be the subject of the sentence anyway? It's dead, for Christ's sakes. Forget about it. 2 pages of the passive voice, just about any business document ever written, in other words, not to mention reams of bad fiction, make me want to scream. It's weak, it's circuitous, and it's frequently torturous as well. How about this? My first kiss will always be recalled by me as how my romance with Shayna was begun. Oh, man, who farted, right? A simpler way to express this idea, sweeter and more forceful as well, might be this. My romance with Shayna began with our first kiss. I'll never forget it. I'm not in love with this because it uses with twice in 4 words, but at least we're out of that awful passive voice. You might also notice how much simpler the thought is to understand when it's broken up into 2 thoughts. This makes matters easier for the reader, and the reader must always be your main concern. Without constant reader, you are just a voice quacking in the void, and it's no walk in the park being the guy on the receiving end. Will Strunk felt the reader was in serious trouble most of the time. E.B. White writes in his introduction to The Elements of Style, a man floundering in a swamp, and that it was the duty of anyone trying to write English to drain this swamp quickly and get his man up on dry ground, or at least throw him a rope. And remember, the writer threw the rope, not the rope was thrown by the writer. Please, oh please.